Well, ladies and gentlemen, here we are, the final week of Baseball Talk for our third season. We got another great show lined up for you. I'm Andy Clark. We have Steve Fitzsimmons. Down there, we have Rob Whiteman. Behind the switches, we have Adam Olivero, as always. Later in the show, we're going to have Jamie Bennett joining us via the big screen. And we're also going to have Paul Hillier in studio with us in the second half of the segment. We have lots of great stuff. We're going to pump up Larry Walker for the Hall of Fame again and all sorts of cool stuff to talk about. But first, we have another great guest. It's our second guest in the last few weeks from the mighty town of Durham. So it seems to be a good thing for us. The last show was really popular with Brad Schaefer. But here we have with us Owen Ron, who is a member of Team Canada's under-17 team that is heading down to Guatemala to try and earn a berth in the World Cup of softball, the U18 World Cup. So welcome to the show, Owen.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, congratulations on this honor to get to represent Team Canada. Has it kind of sunk in yet what it all means?
Yeah, I'm just getting used to it now. Like, putting on the Team Canada jersey for the first time will be really exciting. It's an honor.
Yeah, you've obviously been part of a high-level team, the Belmore Sting that you play for. And, of course, they finished third at the Provincials. And at the Canadian Nationals, you were part of that as well. And that's where you kind of became onto the radar for Team Canada. So you obviously performed well there.
Yeah, they came and watched us. Coaches flew in from, like, Newfoundland, Saskatchewan, some from Ontario. They just came down and watched and scouted, I guess, and saw, like, what they saw, I guess, out of me. So...
So you play shortstop for your main team with
yep.
Belmore, but my understanding is you're going to play in the outfield for Team Canada. How do you feel about that? Is it much of an adjustment for you, you think?
It'll be different for sure when there's ground balls hit out to you, the bumps and stuff in the field rather than a smooth ground in front of you at shortstop, and then fly balls being hit, you have to look up and track them well rather than just pop-ups looking right up, it's coming straight down to you. So
you're doing a little bit different training as a result of that? Or
yeah, for sure. I'm just practicing going over my shoulder and running back and grabbing balls and running around balls. So
mm-hmm. You're a speedy guy anyway, so it's probably not a huge adjustment. And obviously with being a shortstop, you have a great glove, and that's going to probably bode well in the outfield, I'm sure, for you.
Yeah, it'll be a good experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Nationals this year were in Owen Sound. Take us back and tell us a little bit about what that experience was like.
Well, it was a good time. We started off doing pretty good, I'm pretty sure. We won our first few games and then ran into a tough, who was it?
Shallow Lake,
yeah. Tough Shallow Lake team that ended up knocking us out in the bronze medal game. Matthew Weiler, another teammate of ours for Team Canada, he hit a grand slam against us. So,
and he's from Shallow Lake as well,
yeah.
So another local fellow that's going to play
guy.
On that team.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And another member of your team, Jackson Pegolo, who's from Cargill, is also playing on Team Canada. So
yeah.
A couple of guys made the jump from their local team to Team Canada. So, such a feather in your cap. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Pretty high honor for sure.
What other cities were represented from outside of Ontario at the Nationals?
There was Kitchener-Waterloo, Napanee, and Shallow Lake.
Shallow Lake, okay. So,
and also Belmore.
I know sometimes you get teams coming in from either Newfoundland or Saskatchewan or anything, but that's not always the case.
Yeah.
Can throw in a plug for Whiteman there, because I know they cover some softball Nationals. I know a year or two ago we covered the U14 in Palmerston. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of interesting connection there, because if you guys do well down in Guatemala, you then qualify to go to Palmerston, New Zealand.
Yeah.
So that'd be a good opportunity.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Nicer trip than Palmerston, Ontario. No offense to Palmerston, Ontario, but, a little bit more fun.
And I have to say, I'm just burning to know, do people from Palmerston, New Zealand insist that everyone call it Palmerston?
I don't know.
Because, here,
I know.
If you're from Palmerston,
I'm from Arthur originally, so I know the whole deal on that.
I think it's usually just somebody who's 65 or older calls it Palmerston.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so that's your research. You got to qualify for the World Cup, so you can go down and find out how they pronounce it, New Zealand.
So when you go to Guatemala, there's eight teams in that tournament, and you guys have to be in the top four to move on.
Yeah, we have to finish top four to qualify.
Right. And so it's kind of a round robin. Do you play everybody once, or how does that work?
Yeah, the tournament lasts about a week, I'm pretty sure. So we play every team once and then go into finals, and best team comes out of it, I guess, top four.
Right. No, it's exciting.
So I think Adam has a graphic here you can put up for us. This is the first year that they're doing qualifying tournaments for the World Cup. I presume before they went by rankings. So we can see how the formula works there with teams by region. There we go. And I know, for instance, in Asia, they've already had their qualifying tournament. So Japan and Singapore have already punched their ticket. So yeah, Africa sends one representative. The Americas, which I know for sure, Central America and North America, sends four. And looking at that, that would also include South America. Europe sends two, Oceania sends two, and there's a wild card in there. So you have to be top four in your qualifier, but there's also that wild card out there.
Yeah,
I should mention the last U18 was in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and Canada finished fourth, I believe,
yep.
overall. Yep. So.
Okay, and yeah. that would get you through then, eh?
That would do. So yeah, that would be something if you could come back with a gold medal from World Cup of Baseball.
Yeah.
So your background, you played baseball for Durham growing up, and that led you to obviously to Belmore, where you guys have performed extremely well. And, talk about growing up playing baseball in this area, what it's like.
Yeah, it's a really, really good baseball community. They really like to come out and watch. They really support us. Growing up, I always played just in Durham, minor ball. And then when I switched over to Belmore, even just our day games, we had the stands packed over there. So it was a good experience for that.
Did the Toronto Blue Jays, were they any part of you getting involved in baseball or just really just an athletic family and just enjoyed playing? I know you play hockey, obviously, for the Mount Forest Patriots as well, but just kind of what led you to baseball?
Yeah, no, my family is really athletic. My dad played hockey and baseball and was really, really good at hockey, obviously. Enjoyed softball, too, so he kind of got me started in them and then grew up watching the Blue Jays, so that made me want to keep playing and for sure was a boost in my experience.
Should mention your dad, Jeff, led the Junior C loop twice in scoring for the Mount Forest Patriots, and now you're playing for his team. And I mean, just, you know, as an aside, what's that like to play for the team that your dad played for?
Oh, it's fun. For sure. He put up a lot of points. Hopefully I can match that one day. But
right.
So for people watching the graphics, 1994, 1995, you're looking for there. So, yeah.
Yeah,
and so last year you played with Mount Forest as their allowed 116-year-old.
Yep.
So what was your rookie season like?
It was all right. I played more of a grinder role. Didn't really put up the points that I'm used to putting up because I was only 16 playing against older guys. So I only put up like 8 points or something, but played a grinder role. So.
And I believe Hugh Morrison would be pretty mad at us if we didn't mention you were also a Grey Bruce Highlander for a while too. Yeah, went through that organization.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, did you attend any GOJHL camps this year? Or
I didn't go to any Junior B camps this year. I went to Elmira and Listowel last year. And then this year I just wanted to play in Mount Forest again local. So I said, I'm not going to go try out anywhere. Just play there. Have a good season.
You had a good situation going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you're talking about the family athleticism. We should probably slide this in there now too, that mom, who's a Hanover native, she was from the Newby family, Tina Newby. She was a lifeguard. So I knew that because I used to work with her for a few years at the old ancient outdoor pool in Hanover. And mom, Tina, is on the far right there. And was a pretty good swimmer and coached some swimming and stuff along the way there. So, yeah, definitely a lot of athleticism there.
Yeah, yeah.
Just wondering, has Team Canada sent you any swag as of yet? Your jersey or anything like that?
No, we haven't gotten anything yet. We just got an email out today, I believe, that said we get a bunch of free stuff. Like, we get clothing, obviously, and then our uniforms, and then batting gloves, helmet. My parents get a free shirt, something like that. So, yeah.
Any of your family going to Guatemala to watch or not?
My mom and dad will be going.
Oh, good. Yeah. Exciting. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you know about Guatemala? Have you done any research into that at all? Or
I haven't really looked into it. I saw the hotel we're staying in. It looks nice, but other than that, I haven't seen much.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I had a professor. This is total tangent, but I had a professor at university that was an expert on Guatemala, and he was also Scottish. So he always
combo.
So he talked about Guatemala a lot, and he always called it Guatemala. So there you go, Guatemala. So you're there for 10 days, so that'll be quite an adventure.
Yeah.
Might be different food, who knows?
Yeah, it'll be different for sure.
Yes, it'll be an experience for you for sure. Yeah. So if you get through that tournament, obviously you get to go to New Zealand. So when would that take place, and what are your thoughts on New Zealand?
New Zealand is around the late February, early March area. So we'll be missing a bit of hockey for that, but it'll be good.
Exciting, yeah. It's a long ways to go to play, though.
Yeah.
So looking down the road, where are you hoping to go with the softball?
Maybe I'll look into a scholarship. Haven't looked too far ahead, but if there's a scholarship out there, for sure I'll be looking for it. But
heading down to the States, yeah?
Yeah, it'd be exciting. Tell us about, how do you describe yourself maybe as a player? What are your strengths? And
I'd say my most confident strength is my hitting, probably. I have a higher average usually on the team. I feel like I hit the ball hard usually most of the time. So
good defensive player?
Yeah, I'm pretty good at shortstop. That's where I usually play. So it'll be different going to outfield again. But
have you ever played outfield before?
Yeah, before I used to play outfield all the time. Okay. And then I got moved to shortstop.
But, gotcha.
Yeah. Hmm.
So when you went from playing largely hardball to playing softball, what was the biggest transition game-wise?
Just the balls for sure. The hardball obviously flies farther, and softballs just don't go as far. They just die, so it's got to get used to those.
Yeah. Was it a fairly easy transition going from the release point, from being up top to down low? Or?
Yeah, I wasn't too old when I switched, so like it was like they didn't really throw rise balls yet or anything curve balls yet, so it was kind of just a straight-in pitch, so I had to get used to coming from up instead of going down.
Maybe talk to us about some of the people that have helped you develop into the baseball player that you are along the way.
Yeah, my dad coached me for my minor ball years in Durham, so he's been a huge part. And then obviously Chris Fisher, Mike Mulvey, and Chris Eady, and also Brian Busby coached us for 4 years or something. They've impacted me huge for Belmore. They've made me the player I am today. I used to play outfield all the time. Now I'm a shortstop, so they really improved my game.
How much time do you put in sort of in a week for practicing and games? Like what's your schedule look like right now?
Right now I have workouts 3 times a week, and then I go to the diamond once a week.
Okay.
That's my hitting.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
And is it hard to manage along with the hockey, or not too bad?
I only have hockey practice Wednesday nights, and I work around those nights. And then weekends I have hockey games usually. So I take it easy on weekends. I just stay home, don't do much.
So going into the provincials, I mean, were you feeling like this was a possibility that you might have a shot at playing for Team Canada, or was it kind of completely off the radar and it just kind of developed as you played very well?
I had a feeling that they were going to be there watching me because I went to their camp, and there's only like 40 people that went, so they'd choose 15 guys out of 40 from Ontario or whatever, and felt like I had to go to their camp, so I had a feeling they'd be keeping their eye on me. And then I got a phone call about 2 weeks after, and I was pretty excited about that.
And this might be a chance we can fire up the graphic of the roster of the 15 players that are on the team there. And it's kind of neat just to see the spread from where people are from there.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it, I mean, there's a lot of young guys from small communities. You know, Drumbo, Ontario is a tiny little hamlet. Tavistock isn't huge. Cargill, of course, a hamlet. Durham, you know, 2,500 people. Bright, Ontario is a tiny little place. Shakespeare, just outside of Stratford as well, tiny. So, you know, good for small town Ontario punching their way onto this team.
Mm-hmm. And we see there's two representatives from Saskatchewan and two from Quebec and one from Nova Scotia. And really, yeah, if I look at that, the largest community on there would be Belleville, probably. Mm-hmm. Not sure how big Prince Albert is, but probably not that much.
And Annie, I don't know, you might know better than me, but maybe this is a function of softball being more popular in small town communities across Canada than maybe in larger centers. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's kind of like euchre, where culturally it's carried on in small towns a little bit more. And I think a factor, we had Ron Pegg on a few years ago,
right,
and he mentioned how a lot of cities, just because real estate becomes so valuable for so many things,
a
lot of baseball diamonds have been turned into other usage, right?
What a shame, eh?
And when they had that big boost after the Blue Jays had the playoff run, there was a big boost in interest, and they were caught short of diamonds. But I think in a lot of our small towns, maybe those diamonds have remained. So that's probably a factor. The facilities are still there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even when Wayne Martin was on earlier in the season, he talked about the same thing, kind of starting to see a little bit of an upswing in getting kids interested again. Soccer drew a lot of kids away. It was, you know, just something that became really popular. There's maybe a little more movement and whatnot in soccer, and that was a little more appealing to parents. But there seems to be a bit more of an upswing again with softball.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that ebb and flow that's kind of developed. But obviously, small town Canada producing some high quality players. Owen, we're super excited for you to qualify for this team, and you know, we're looking forward to seeing you in action. And is there a way that anyone can stream these games there or watch them?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're live streamed on the Softball Canada website. Just go on there, and then there should be a link. You just click on it, and it'll take you to the game.
Well, I suspect there'll be a lot of people from Durham and Hanover watching that link over that 10-day span, and we want to wish you all the best and good luck at the tournament.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
So that's Owen Ron, and we'll take a break, and we'll be back with more on Baseball Talk right after this.
Welcome back to the final episode of Baseball Talk for the season. It was a great interview we had with Durham's Owen Ron. He's doing the area proud, so good on him. And I know people will be keeping tabs on his progress as they head down to Guatemala. Filling a seat right now is host Paul Hillier. Welcome aboard, Paul.
Thank you. Nice to be back finally for after a little bit of a hiatus, but glad I made it for the last show.
And what we're going to do is we're going to jump in with Clark Ives from the Clark Ives. Headline on this says, Rod Carew officially is named AL batting champ. And this is from Spartanburg Herald Journal from 1969, December 14th, 1969. And we'd actually been looking at Tony Bautista and his strange batting stance, and we were talking about different batting stances. And that got me thinking of Rod Carew, who I really enjoyed him as a baseball player and often had really high average.
Yeah, when you think of the annals of baseball, if you will, some of the best hitters, he's certainly a name that comes to the forefront. You know, you think of him, you think of George Brett, you think of Tony Gwynn, those kind of guys. He's definitely in that sort of upper tier of the best that's ever played the game, I think, for average.
And right now with the Blue Jays, we see that young, dynamic trio there. Of course, Kevin Biggio with the cycle last night,
right,
and two stolen bases. Glad to see some Blue Jays finally running. And obviously with Bichette and Guerrero. But here they had a triumvirate back in 1969 with the Twins that were just doing remarkable things. So at this point, it was the first time Rod Carew had hit over 300. He was in his third or fourth season in 1969. He won the batting title with a 332 after spending a few months hovering around 400. So that was pretty impressive. But the other big names going on there, Tony Oliva, who was runner-up for the batting title. He was tied for second with a 309 average, led the league in doubles, led the league in hits. So Tony Oliva was doing a lot of pretty cool stuff there. He'd won a couple of batting titles around that time himself. And then Harmon Killebrew. I'll come back to Harmon in a second here. I do want to mention here, they mentioned that Carl Yastrzemski had led the league in batting the year before with a, they said it was, at that time it was a record low, 301. Was the highest batting average.
Wow.
And of course, last night, a relative of his, Yastrzemski.
Mike Yastrzemski, his grandson, playing for the Giants, parked one at Fenway Park, dead center.
Yeah. A lot of teary eyes in Boston last night.
Yep. Family, yeah.
And not usually a big fan of the Boston Red Sox or their fans or the city just in general, but got to tip your cap to them. Gave him a standing O, gave the kid a standing O. Pretty special moment to have Yastrzemski playing at Fenway again after so many years.
And so, hitting a home run, that's so cool. Absolutely.
Batting left just like his grandfather as well.
Yeah.
I know you're going to come back to Harmon Killebrew, but I mean, when you think of Harmon Killebrew, you think of the power that Harmon Killebrew had, and not so much that he hit for average, but obviously he was among the AHL batting leaders there.
Yes. Yeah. And in this case, in this year, he won his sixth American League home run title.
It's amazing.
I didn't realize Harmon had that many. I knew he won a few.
He was
but
high
six,
level yeah. power. Yeah.
Yeah. So he had 49 dingers to take the home run title, and he had 140 RBIs, which was tops in the league, and he was the league MVP in 1969. So there's a triumvirate doing a.
And that's all on one team. Bats.
All in one team in 1969.
And I mean,
Minnesota Twins.
Different era, but you think back to that era, and I mean, you know, they earned their home runs the hard way with pure power and, you know, not steroids, not
the juiced balls of today.
Exactly. I mean, you know, 49 then is like 75 or 80 now. Mm-hmm. You know, like these guys were true professionals in hitting and, you know, I think a lot of people think back to that era quite fondly with those names that are mentioned.
And speaking of the home run race, let's bring on our good friend Jamie Bennett. So Jamie Bennett, great to have you back on. A few weeks ago, some of us were talking about a Twitter poll here where we were making predictions about who was going to end up with the home run title this year. And things certainly have changed in the last week or so.
They have. And I mean, like we've seen injuries to Christian Yelich and Mike Trout now, and those were two of the big names I know that we had discussed. But right now, I think it looks like Pete Alonso is going to be the guy to beat. I know we've got Suarez, who's just one behind him. But Pete Alonso's having a year for the books, for sure.
Jamie, I mean, 48 dingers right now as we talk, and this guy's a rookie. It's pretty amazing stuff.
It is. And I mean, like, seeing the kind of year that he's put up is... I don't know if it takes a bit of the sting out of seeing Vladdy lose the home run derby, despite all the dingers that he put up. It's certainly impressive, and I mean it's great news for Mets fans.
Kind of reminiscent of Aaron Judge just a couple of years ago with the Yankees too, where I think he hit 52 home runs in his rookie season.
Oh, if he could go back to that now, guys.
Yeah.
What does he have, like 19 or something?
Yeah.
No, but he's been hurt.
No, I know he's been hurt. Actually, he hasn't played bad. He just hasn't been playing much. That's yeah. all.
But. Speaking of 19 dingers, though, like Vladdy isn't even the rookie leader for home runs on the Blue Jays, because technically that's Rowdy Tellez. He's right. technically a rookie this year. And
yep.
I don't know if he's got to 20 yet, but I know he was sitting at 19 recently. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, let's have a look here.
Not bad for
Guerrero Jr. 15 home runs, 65 runs batted in, and got to look a long way down to find the average. I'm just looking here as we do this live.
Well, that's where Tellez is going to need
Tellez,
to improve his overall batting average.
Tellez, he has 19 and 49 runs batted in right now.
49.
Yeah, and he's hitting a whopping 219. Which is
you look at a guy like Pete Alonso, though, and you see the difference between. A Tellez, who is going to get better, but Alonso's swing is almost perfection. You just watch right. him every time he swings. Right. He's in full control. There's none of this wild. Like, he'll never be considered one of those free swingers that, you know, might hit a home run or he might strike out 50 times in a row. He's got a really controlled, nice, level swing. And when he hits a ball, it's going to go a long way.
If he stays healthy, he's going to be a beast. Yeah. And probably a good... piece for them to build around in New York Mets. They really need something like that. They need some stability.
He looks like he's going to be the centerpiece of that team for the next decade or more.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when we did our poll, our four choices at that time were the top four. Were at that time Trout was number one with Yelich and Bellinger, and Pete Alonso was fourth at that point as right. leapfrog. So we know Trout and Yelich are out with injuries for the rest of the year. Bellinger, four back. Do you think he has a chance to take that home run title?
You don't ever count out Bellinger out of the equation. That's a guy who can get streaky, and he might hit five or six in a week.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
it's unlikely he's going to close the gap by four when Alonso's playing really well. But, you know, he's the only guy left really that has a shot at it. I guess Suarez at 47, but he's been a bit quiet of late. So, I don't know. I think Pete Alonso's in the driver's seat here. What do you think, Jamie? Do you think he's the winner?
I think he's going to be the winner, barring anything really surprising. The other thing I was looking at was I don't know if there's going to be anybody that reaches the 50 stolen base mark either. Only one guy, as I recall, has hit 40, and we're reaching the end of the season for somebody to hit 50, which would be kind of cool as well.
You know what? You bring up an interesting point. I mean, how when we look back into the late 80s and early 90s, speed on the base pass was such a weapon. You know, you had Ricky Henderson, who was a one-man wrecking crew, you know, and he would get, you know, 100-plus stolen bases. And before that, Lou Brock. I mean, where are those guys these days? Yeah. Like, you got to think there's somebody that is capable of that, but is it just the game has evolved to a point where they just don't give them the opportunities now? I just don't know what it is.
I think that comes down to the analytics, and they're saying that a stolen base isn't as valuable as, you know, taking pitches and getting walks. And
or the risk of the out is what
the risk of the out is an issue.
Yeah,
yeah, it's just...
But, and I've said this before, but the analytics falls down here because it can't get all the variables, right? Because we know that, for instance, if you have a base dealer on first, that puts pressure on the pitcher. He's pitching over there. He's distracted. He might hang a few balls in the middle of the strike zone. He wouldn't normally because he's got his mind on first base or second base. So that's translating into hits that analytics will never capture, right? It's also putting pressure on the infield. It's also drawing the infield out of position. So you're maybe creating a hole where, you know, so these are things that analytics are not able to get a hold of. Or how many even, like, attempted throwouts from the catcher end up in the outfield, right? So there's so much benefit to the stolen base. And to that end, last night, the Blue Jays have been incredibly stingy with allowing their players to try stealing bases. Kevin Biggio had two last night. And the first, his second stolen base where he stole third, where normally that would have been an inning ended on a long fly ball, he stole third. He's able to score the inning would have been over. But you know what I'm saying there. He scored a run on a sacrifice fly that normally wouldn't have happened.
You know, I mean, so, you bring up a great point, Andy. It definitely changes the mindset and the mental approach of the opposing team and puts pressure on them in a number of ways. But also, it really puts the wind at your back. If you're the team that steals the base, suddenly you have a little more swagger. The guy at the plate, you know, he's got a gut, especially if it's second that you stole, you got a runner in scoring position from a guy that was on first. If you steal third, suddenly if there's only one out, you've got, you know, a fly ball is going to score a run. I mean, Jamie, it's weird how it just doesn't have much of a role in baseball anymore.
It doesn't, but that doesn't mean that it's not valuable. I mean, you guys were mentioning a few names there that were a little bit before my, and I mean, like, certainly I'm familiar with guys like Ricky Henderson, you know, and the lore that goes along with those guys. But the one that always comes to mind for me was Carl Crawford, guy who spent some time with the Tampa Bay Rays, Boston Red Sox, and LA Dodgers. And I mean, I remember the day that he stole, I think it was 6 or 7 bases in a single game. And I mean, like, that's valuable to a team. And, you know, when he left Tampa, I think that they felt that. And I mean, I remember at the time, Desmond Jennings was supposed to be the replacement for him. And I honestly couldn't tell you where Desmond Jennings is now.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything from him in a while.
Yeah, so finding those guys is difficult. But number one, you've got to know how to utilize them. And number two, you know, you've got to be willing to utilize them. And I think you guys were saying, you know, some teams are a little bit reluctant to do so.
I think the game has changed, though. It goes back to like any other sport, including hockey now. Everything is all about getting bigger, faster, stronger. They're going more power now. We want to see you hit 50 home runs and not steal 50 bases. The only one in the majors this year that really has a chance at it, and I think that's who Jamie was referring to, is probably Adalberto Mondesi. Right. Who is around the 40-ish mark. He has a shot at it, and he's a little speed demon out there. But there are other fast guys in this league, and they should be utilizing that more because these guys are getting so injured today because their muscles are so strung out because they all want to be bigger and bigger muscles, and they're just snapping like twigs.
You know, the other thing that occurs to me, and I've often thought about this in the past, and I've never really seen it, but, you know, you have, you know, say, world-class 100-meter sprinters, right? Like, why wouldn't a team at some point have that as their 25th man on the roster as a pinch runner situation and just force the opposition, like, huge in that one scenario a game to... I mean, are roster spots too valuable to do that? I don't know.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
You only get maybe 2 bench players, 3, depending on how many relief pitchers you have. So if you get into a long game, you don't want to have a guy who can just steal a base,
right?
Hoping that someone gets on base for him to replace, because now you have to replace the player who he's replacing with another player. So you're going to use up, waste three guys just to maybe steal one base, and that just wouldn't jive.
Just too much, maybe.
It's just too much risk.
I think that's probably where we talked about Dalton Pompey the last show. That's where you're seeing, you know, he's valuable off the bench for something like that, but he doesn't have all the tools to carry him for a full season. And that's probably where the problem is.
So when we're talking analytics and stats, you know, I think when the stolen base, I really feel analytics falls short. But some other statistics we're talking about here, we know that there's an emphasis on the home run now, because analytics basically says don't put the ball in play. If you put her over the fence, the other side, if you strike them out, don't let them put it in play. So the game's really focused on strikeouts and home runs. There's a lot of talk about how the baseball itself is a big factor in that. And we have some interesting data that really points to something bizarre going on with baseballs in Major League Baseball. Previous to this year, the minor leagues used a very different ball. They talk about the seams being very different, the core being different, the leather being different. So they thought to make the transition to the big leagues a little smoother. This year, they had AAA use Major League Baseballs. So AA level below continued using whatever they were using. What's interesting is in AA and single-A ball, there was actually a drop in the number of home runs. In AAA baseball this year, whereas last year when AAA was using the old baseball, they had 3,652 home runs. By going to the Major League Baseball, they've increased by more than 2,100.
Crazy.
In a single year. To give it some perspective, midway through the season, home runs in AAA were up over 65% as of May, and they ended the year up about 50-some percent.
Stunning, really.
Stunning for a single year. So Major League Baseball probably
they've
laughing.
Juiced the ball. They've juiced the
laughing
ball.
Behind closed doors or claiming nothing's going on. But we also, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence in AAA where players that have never hit more than 11 home runs in single-A or double-A are all of a sudden crushing 25, 26, 27. And even in the major leagues, we're seeing players hitting. Here was a stat from end of July going into August. They only looked at teams that hadn't changed their stadiums. So that, you know, being a variable. So teams in the same stadiums, there's 29 in AAA. And as of beginning of August, 22 out of the 29 had already surpassed their previous home run total. And six of them had already surpassed it by more than 50 home runs.
Crazy.
As of the end of July. Like, that's insane.
It's nuts.
So it brings up a lot of questions here. First of all, does it make the game more entertaining?
I guess it all depends on your perspective on how much you enjoy a home run, is really the truth of it. I think Major League Baseball, there's no question they believe that it does.
Yep.
And fans certainly get juiced up about home runs in large part, I think. But, you know, this kind of exponential growth to me is excessive, I think. And it also cheapens what a guy hitting 30 home runs actually is now. Because there's just so many guys.
I agree with you. I think the old saying, chicks dig the long ball, you know, the old Atlanta Braves commercial.
Right.
You know, where Glavin and Smoltz are going to start hitting for power and chicks dig the long ball. But you know what? I think probably what MLB is doing is they're looking back to 1998 and what was going on there. They're saying, well, we can't put the needles in the arms of the baseball players anymore because we got caught doing that. We'll juice the balls instead. And they're trying to grab our attention. There's an attendance issue in
huge
baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Big one.
Related to the length of the game, yeah.
I mean, the two teams in Florida combined in one night might draw 10,000 people.
Yeah. It's sad.
It's pathetic. And so I think they're getting worried. Baseball is recording lots of profits, but they're signing all these deals with gambling companies and whatnot.
Yeah.
And the TV deals that they've got, that's where their money's coming in. It's not through the tickets, They're not putting butts in the seats anymore, and they're trying to do that. And I think that's what's going on. And right around the All-Star break, someone did come out and say, yeah, they're juiced. And then they pulled back real quick.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't. I spoke out of turn. They're
not. Yeah, there was something said there around the All-Star break somewhere. Someone admitted, whether it was Rob Manfred, the commissioner, or what.
Yeah.
He did admit it at first, and now they're kind of backpedaling a bit. But the pitchers have been complaining for the last couple of seasons that there's something with the grip, how they're the texture of the ball, and that's why they're getting all these blisters. And you know, you got to feel for the pitchers too, because these guys like Pete Alonso in his rookie year will maybe hit 50 home runs, and he's going to get a big fat paycheck out of that. But the pitchers are going to be hurting from this,
yeah.
You know. And how do you go into arbitration afterwards? And
I think you have to do it.
Say, you didn't pitch all that level of home runs.
I think you have to compare yourself to your fellow players. So you know, it'll be a ranking system where you know I was the fifth best pitcher in Major League Baseball for ERA, even though it was 4.21 or whatever. Right?
Yep.
I mean, Jamie, what's kind of your perspective on this home run situation?
Well, I think it's going to be that the fans are drawn to home runs, and you know that's going to be at the cost of the pitchers if they are making the balls more home run friendly, because you simply can't help the defense and the offense at the same time. So I mean, I think what you said about, you know, having to compare it against other players rather than stats is probably the best way to go about it. And I mean, like, you know, you see this in other sports leagues to a degree as well. I mean, the NHL, we saw them want to increase scoring after the 06 lockout. And, you know, they've gone about that a few different ways, including making sure that goalie equipment's not all that big. And I mean, like, you know, you think about guys like maybe Garth Snow, who had that really big equipment. And I mean, you think that an extra puck or two isn't going to sneak by when your pads are smaller than you're used to? I mean, it's really hard to benefit the game as in general when you're, you know, introducing new rules or different ideas, because you're going to end up helping one side of it more than the other. And I think that if they are changing up these baseballs, then they're helping the offense, but they're not helping the defense.
Yeah. And I want to pick up on a point some of you have made here, because not only come contract time does it get confusing for hitters and pitchers. Think about back in the AAA level, evaluating your talent, right? We have guys that have been in the minors for 5 years, never hitting more than 11, all of a sudden having a spike when they get to these baseballs. Well, is this something they can recreate, can do consistently, or are they going to be a Chris Davis situation? Your pitcher, like, do they really stink, or is it something to do with these balls, right? So the whole evaluation of talent gets skewed and thrown off.
You know, it's interesting when you say that, because the Toronto Blue Jays, of course, are trying to develop a pitching staff of some semblance right now. And of course, a lot of their hopes are pinned on this, a lot of guys in AAA this year. And so how do you sort of rate those guys when you have this these stats in AAA that, you know, suddenly a 4.75 earned run average maybe isn't that bad because of the amount of juicing in the balls?
Mm-hmm. And like, for instance, we had Rob Fay on from the Vancouver Canadiens last week, and right. He was talking about at single A, you know, the bats weren't all that impressive, but they're still using the sort of the dead ball or whatever you want to call it. So you have to almost magnify their numbers compared to a AAA.
If these guys are able to get to AAA,
yeah.
are their numbers going to spike? And then are they able to do that again?
Jamie, you were going to say?
Yeah, like, I mean, it depends on the type of pitcher that they are as well. Because, like, if you get a guy who's a ground ball pitcher, think like a Mark Burley, then they're probably going to suffer more from a home run friendly baseball than somebody like, you know, I mean, it's maybe a bad example, but like a Clayton Kershaw, who's going to arguably get upwards of 200 strikeouts a year. Because, you know, these guys, if they can't hit it, then they can't send it out of the park. But it's certainly going to depend on, you know, the type of pitcher as well as the type of equipment.
And I'd say the whole home run emphasis is probably contributing to the length of games, which you're saying is a big factor in why people are staying home in droves. And even on TV, it's becoming an issue with these games getting longer and longer and longer.
The other thing is, and I don't have any numbers at all to back this up, but I'm going to assume that based on the home run numbers that we're seeing some exponential growth in extra base hits in general, with the doubles and triples as well, where, you know, a ball that might have just got out of the infield and got caught on the edge of the infield maybe trickles into, you know, into right field for a single now or whatever, or rolls for a double that would have been just a single before. You have to think that that, you know, and again, we don't have numbers to sort of justify that stance, but I would imagine that it likely is that.
Even the speeds off the bat are greater now. They're much harder. We're seeing fans get injured on foul balls, and they're having to extend the netting down the lines. This, I think, is probably even more or broader than just home runs when it comes to this juiced ball. Like, it's getting hit harder. You'll probably see a lot more errors and just stuff like that as well.
And are we going to look at some point, if they change things up years from now, are they going to have to put an asterisk beside players from this era when it comes time for Hall of Fame balloting? Because just like we know, there's a whole pile there, that big question mark about steroid abusers that some people are softening on, some aren't. Well, are we going to have to put an asterisk beside the people who had the rabbit ball going over the fence for them when they sneeze?
In my mind, no. And the reason for that is because it wasn't the player's fault in this case, whereas putting a banned substance or substances in your body to try to increase your power is a different scenario altogether, where, you know, you were doing something untoward to help yourself, as opposed to, you know, Major League Baseball being obviously privy to this and actually implementing this. You may look at it a little differently, but I don't think Hall of Fame voters at the end of the day, say this era goes on for 4 or 5 years, I don't think they're going to hold it against those players necessarily.
Another thing to look at with from the pitching side of this ball issue too is, if your name is Clayton Kershaw or Justin Verlander, does it really affect you as much? Because these guys are throwing the ball so good that the guys can't hit the ball. So at the end of the day, you know, we can say that the pitcher stats are getting inflated because of these balls. And, well, if you're a good pitcher and you don't let the guys hit the ball, they're not going to hit it out.
No.
So, you know, I think it's going to stay this way, though, because there's more runs being scored. There's more home runs. The fans that are attending games are excited about seeing the home runs going out of the park. And I really can't see them bringing it back, because that would just lose the fans that are starting to attend.
It's funny, Paul, because at the high end, it actually maybe exacerbates the guys, like you said, the Clayton Kershaws and some of the Verlanders, where they actually maybe stand out even more than they would in another sort of era, of just how good they are. And I mean, Jamie, when you look at those guys, I mean, they really are elite and stand above maybe their compatriots even further than in other seasons.
Well, it's true. I mean, like, are we ever likely to see another pitcher that can strike out 393 guys in a season? It's pretty unlikely. But to sort of comment on a point that you made earlier, the difference between the baseballs now and the steroid era is also that everybody's playing with the same equipment now. And I mean, back when, you know, some of these guys were using performance-enhancing drugs, it was just a select group of players. It wasn't everybody doing it. Whereas, you know, now, you know, whether you're Pete Alonso or Ryan Gomes, you're playing with the same equipment. And I mean, you know, if it jacks up, you know, Pete Alonso to 50 home runs, where he would hit, say, 40 without the different ball, and, you know, if you're Ryan Gomes, maybe you hit 5 instead of 3. I don't know. But it's going to benefit everybody who is playing on the offensive side of the ball, where instead of a select few who are, you know, breaking the rules. If it's all legit and they're all doing the same thing, then it's still a level playing field.
Yeah, I think
Go ahead, Rob.
Baseball's got all kinds of eras. Probably just the darkest one is the steroid era.
Right.
But there was dead ball era. You know, there was a time where, you know, people say that Babe Ruth is the greatest baseball player ever. He didn't face Satchel Paige. There was no integration, you know. So there's different eras of baseball that, you know, this will fall into, and they'll talk about the live ball era at some time. And, you know, I think maybe we'll look at it with a little more fondness. Maybe that's not the word I'm looking for, but than we did the steroid era. Because we all just seem to want to forget that, you know.
Well, some people do and some people don't. You hear more and more people saying, you know, they don't care and they got to vote it in, but or vote them in for the Hall of Fame I'm talking about there, which is too bad. I do want to bring it around while we have some time there, guys. Canadian baseball player Larry Walker, this year he's on his 10th and final Hall of Fame ballot, and it's actually a disgrace to the game of baseball. I'm sounding like Ryan Drury right now, but I've got a channel. It is an absolute garbage that he is not in the Hall of Fame and that he might not make it on the 10th ballot. He did get up to 54.6% last year.
And he needed, what, 75?
I believe
75, yes.
75. And if you look at his stats, it is a black mark on the baseball that he's not in there. It's partly because he's Canadian. There's
that
puke-worthy.
Do you think he gets penalized for the Colorado era?
They say that all the time.
Absolutely.
I think it's so wrong.
People on one side don't care about steroids will say he played. And you're right. The Colorado excuse is ridiculous.
It's nonsense.
Yeah. Because if you look at, A, he played his career, a lot of it in Montreal. Yeah. He played a little bit in St. Louis. And he played a lot of away games when he played for Colorado. And a lot of what he did, he was equally dynamic on the road as he well. It says here where 278, a 370, 495 on the road, equaled or bested by only 24 players in Major League history. So his road hitting, when it like in, it's just so many things here. You could go on and on. His Gold Gloves, his Silver Slugger awards. He's a guy that led the league in home runs and
average
on base percentage. In the same season, he won batting titles. The guy was a great fielder.
What else does he need to do? What else did he need
to do? He stole bases at more than a 75%. He stole a lot of bases at more than a 75% success rate.
And if Colorado is the factor here, why isn't a Colorado Rocky the leader in home runs every year?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
So it's got nothing to do. I mean, yeah, I get the stadium's a little elevated because of the height in that city.
But he hits everywhere. He hit everywhere.
Yeah, he hit everywhere.
Yep.
Absolutely. And if the ball going out of Colorado happens that much, the Colorado Rockies team should be hitting more home runs than any other team in baseball, and they're not.
And really, they haven't had a crew like they did with Walker and Bichette and Galarraga back in the 90s. They haven't had that since, Tulo. And then they say even that affected Tulo with his body, that the elevation, all the injuries he had down the road later in his career. So I mean, don't give me that it benefits you. If I saw a list somewhere and I went looking for it, but I couldn't find it for the show. But there is a list somewhere where Walker is on with a bunch of other former players, with right in there with home runs, hits, average, on base, all the stats. And every name around him is in the Hall of Fame.
Absolutely.
There's no reason why.
It's an absolute disgrace, and I think you had the word right, Andy, that this is even going to this point. This guy should have been a first ballot Hall of Famer, bar none. Yeah. Look at his numbers. Stack them up against the game's best ever, and he's right among them all.
Here's right to that wit. The last four outfielders that have been elected to the Hall of Fame were in reverse order. Vladimir Guerrero, Andre Dawson, Tim Raines, and first ballot unanimous choice, Ken Griffey Jr.
Yeah.
If you look at the wins against replacement for those players compared to Larry Walker, Larry Walker would be second ahead of Tim Raines, Andre Dawson, Vladimir Guerrero. He would be second with 72.7 behind only Ken Griffey Jr., who was a first ballot Hall of Fame unanimous choice.
And justifiably so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and it says here with the slash line, seven players in MLB history with at least a .313 batting average, on base percentage of .400, and slugging percentage of .565. There's only six other players that have matched that. And those six other players were Babe Ruth, Jimmy Fox, Ted Williams, Lou Gehrig, Hank Greenberg, and Rogers Hornsby.
So how can the baseball writers be so, or the Hall of Fame committee be so wrong here?
Is it the Canadian bias?
I think it is the writers at this point.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't get in now, I do have faith that he will get in down the road, similar to Harold Reynolds this year. He got in a kind of a players category type thing, where the other members kind of voted it in, and former players voted him in. I do feel that he will get in that way, but it would be nice to be, for him to get in.
Jamie, do you think it's a case to, I mean, we talked about the Colorado angle, but the Montreal Expos angle, a small market baseball market that didn't get a lot of U.S. television exposure, and the writers, of course, you know, are impacted by, you know, media. Of course, it's not like it, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, you really didn't have the convergence that you have of instantaneous highlights on Twitter and Facebook and all escalated out of this world in like 10 minutes after it happened. I feel like he's shortchanged in that way from that era where, you know, in Montreal, there was maybe limited media coverage versus some of the other markets.
Yeah, and that's quite possible. I mean, it you know, like you said, the media availability perhaps just wasn't there when Larry Walker was playing. But I mean, I think the opposite argument to that is that, you know, there are players that have gotten in that have comparable stats or even, you know, lesser stats that played for teams that weren't the New York Yankees, weren't the Boston Red Sox, or, you know, some of those really, really high profile teams. So, I mean, I do think Larry Walker deserves to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. You know, he deserves to go to Cooperstown and all that stuff. But I honestly can't say with any sort of certainty what it is that's kept him out.
You know, I said Harold Reynolds earlier.
Harold
Baines.
Yeah.
And that's this actually what Jamie is saying right there kind of fits in with my argument.
Right.
Larry Walker was a better player than Harold Baines.
Oh, there's no question about that. As good as Harold Baines was.
Yeah, and I think right there, that is what I think you set precedent when they've brought Harold in this year. And I hate that everybody's kind of dumping on his selection because the guy should, you know, be feeling good about getting picked for the Hall of Fame. But, you know,
I mean,
I think it sets precedent. And I do believe one way or another, Walker will get in. I just don't know that it's going to be this year.
I mean, when you think about the reverence we have, and in fairness to the Toronto market, you know, we have a reverence for Joe Carter, how good Joe Carter was as a power hitter and player. And he's not even in the same category as Larry Walker for me.
No.
Like, he had that great moment. He was a great player, hit a lot of home runs and RBIs for years. He was 100 RBI, 30 home run man, a ton of years.
He was a power guy throughout the league, every team he went to before he came to Toronto.
I mean, he really was, but it's not even a comparison, is it?
No, because he didn't steal bases. Defensively, he was mediocre at best, whereas Larry Walker, you put him out in the outfield, he had a cannon for an arm. He was accurate when he was going to retrieve
like
fly
a
ball.
Vacuum.
Yeah, yep.
And 7-time Gold Glove winner. Yeah.
Walker actually used to throw guys out from right field at first base.
Yeah,
I can remember him doing it.
I've seen him do it a couple of times.
I can remember screaming at the TV.
I've mentioned at the show that he's such a baseball lifer gamer. Where there was the one play where he read the outfield fence perfectly, where he realized the ball was he was positioned shallow, and it was carrying, and he knew it was going to go off the wall. So he mimed that it was popped up, right? And the player slowed down a bit because he thought it was a fly ball. He mimed it right through, and he let it travel all the way back and hit the fence. Then he turned around, and it had careened right to him. And he turned around, and he threw the guy out at second by a mile because he mimed him with – and, like, who thinks of this stuff, right? Like, A Hall of Famer
absolutely
does, right?
Does.
So, yeah.
And you know what? You bring up a good point, Andy, about the fact of what a – or Paul, I guess it was you – the cannon of an arm. I mean, obviously – that was not affected by Colorado in any way, shape, or form.
No.
You just that guy was just a defensive stalwart, as indicated by all of his gold gloves and basically being so decorated in that way. I mean, this guy defensively is a Hall of Famer, offensively is a Hall of Famer, average-wise is a Hall of Famer. I mean, he just it's a shame. I really am confounded by the issue of why he's not even, I mean, this is his final year to be into the Hall of Fame. And, you know, he may get there. You know, he was obviously in the ballpark 55%. You know, he has to get to 75. I think there'll be some baseball writers that'll maybe give him his due this year. And hopefully the teams that he played for, you know, obviously Colorado will be representing, trying to get him in there. But, and maybe some Canadian baseball fans trying as well. But, you know, I hope he gets his due this year. I really do.
And I think if he goes in as a Rocky, that would be the first Rocky to wear a
– Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
The other thing I disagree with kind of with the Hall of Fame process is that why should it be limited to, well, we can only put in three or four guys a year? If there are 10 available in that given year that deserve to be in, if you're good enough to get in the Hall of Fame, you should be in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if, oh, there was 10 guys better than you in this situation, and now there's 7 better than you this next year. It doesn't matter. If you're a Hall of Famer, you're a Hall of Famer. And
yep. I do think there should be parameters around it, for sure, because I think one thing the NHL does is they're a little free and easy with who they let in and whatnot. But I think there should be parameters around it, but there should not be a limit. Absolutely not.
Well, and maybe some years there only is one person goes in. Other years there's 9. You know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, Jamie, I think, you know, they don't want the perception, much like maybe we have of the NHL, that, you know, the Hall of Fame line is, you know, a little tepid about some of the people that maybe get in. But maybe they're a little too harsh the other way.
Yeah, and I think that there's something to be said about, you know, having a set number of years that a guy can enter the Baseball Hall of Fame. Like, I mean, we saw, I think it was Dick Duff a few years back, who, you know, has been retired for decades, but was only introduced to the Hockey Hall of Fame a few years ago. And I mean, like, if he's the best player outside of the league who is not in the Hockey Hall of Fame. And I mean, I think that the argument is being made that Larry Walker is one of, if not the best baseball player, not currently in Cooperstown, then why would you not induct them that year, regardless of how many years they've been out? That would be my response to the current way of doing things.
And to my mind, too, it speaks to the credibility of these sports writers, too. Because you're right, like, he was in a small market in Montreal. All of those things. But guess what? We have the internet. We can find clips. And if these people are voting on this, they have a responsibility to do it in an educated and informed way. Yeah. And I think it actually maybe speaks possibly to maybe a decline in sports writing over the last few years.
Could be. You know, guys, we're down to our final 2 minutes of baseball talk for the season. And the Toronto Blue Jays have rallied to try not to lose 100 games. They've won their last two series. Just a final quick thought on the Toronto Blue Jays, Rob.
Looking forward to next season. I don't have high expectations. I think it's going to be similar to this year. I do think they will see some improvement in the rookies, but there still isn't the pitching, unless they surprise me in the offseason with some free agent signings.
Paul?
I've got to agree with Rob. Pitching is still the concern. As the Toronto Maple Leafs in hockey have been for years, they were lacking on defense. They've upgraded their defense for this year. Toronto has got to do something with pitching. They've got plenty of offense. Their team defense will only get better as these rookies progress. They still have to work on pitching because right now they have very little. And even their prospects are going to be a few years yet before they're top-notch.
Jamie?
Yeah, I agree with both Paul and Rob. It's going to be another growing pains. At least we know there's a few highlights coming with Biggio, Bichette, and Guerrero. And I'm looking forward to...
Now I want to say goodbye to Justin Smoke, who's been nothing but a class act and probably not back with the Jays, so good on him. And remember to check our show's Twitter feed during the offseason. We'll still put polls and some good stuff out there.
Guys, we had a lot of great guests this season. It was a lot of fun. And the four of you, it was a pleasure to work with you. And I know a few of you will be back for Hockey Talk. We'll take a hiatus for a couple of weeks, and Hockey Talk will be back in this time slot. And we'll look forward to talking some Mitch Marner and having some good hockey guests upcoming this season. But it was a lot of fun, guys. Great working with you.
Yeah, it's been a good season.
Yep. It was. So,
even though I missed half of it.
Another great episode of Baseball Talk. Thanks to Owen Ron. And we'll see you next time. It'll be Hockey Talk on deck next time.